Okay, you better improve your communication skills so you can deal with conflict resolution, so you can deal with decision making, so you can figure out how to share your resources, so you can eat together without arguing, so forth. Okay, and there's a lot of things you can do, a lot of trainings you can work on, a lot of books you can read, there's a lot of information out there. You better have a clear membership process. If you're interested in community, even a sense of community in a group, if you don't know who's in the group and who isn't, and you take in just anybody, you're not valuing your community. Community is precious in our culture, it's a scarce resource, and you better value it, and that means you have to do something about membership. It's a sad thing to have to do, but there are times when you don't have the resources to incorporate this person into your group. My community understands we are not a therapeutic community. We are not psychiatrists and psychologists and clinical therapists. We know that our community is therapeutic for the people in it, but we cannot take in large numbers of people who are broken beyond the normal amount. Okay. And lastly, we need to identify, it really helps the group to have some form of community space. We have a community center. It's open to anybody in our community, including the larger community, the folks who come to potluck. My stepdaughter and her family live in a little cul-de-sac street in Baltimore, which happens to have one little triangle that didn't get built on, and it has grass. That triangle is the center of their community. It's a functioning neighborhood, primarily because of that triangle and the fact you can't drive through it in a hurry. It's being a loop. So community space can make a big difference. All right, what have we got left? Oh, I said personal sharing was part of the retreat and the retreat process a lot of times. Okay, so we got some websites. If you're interested in intentional community or even in community in general, www.ic.org, directory.ic.org. This is a new online community directory that just came on in October. This is where you can buy interesting things, books and other stuff about community. And if you want to buy things that are made in intentional communities and support their home businesses, look at communitymade.org. Now, if I might, I have one thing I'd like to read from the book Beyond the Limits. And this is actually part of it is from a review and part of it in a magazine called In Context, which many of you may know. And part of it is the book itself, from the review. What are the elements of the sustainability revolution? They go beyond good information, new technologies, democratic participation, and sound policy. The authors close their book with a description of five tools that are generally not mentioned in most supposedly serious studies of what we must do. Visioning, networking, truth-telling, learning, and loving. All right? One is, and this is from the book, one is not allowed in the modern culture to speak about love except in the most romantic and trivial sense of the word. Anyone who calls upon the capacity of people to practice brotherly and sisterly love is more likely to be ridiculed than to be taken seriously. The deepest difference between optimists and pessimists is their position in the debate about whether human beings are able to operate collectively from a basis of love. In a society that systematically develops in people their individualism, their competitiveness, and their cynicism, the pessimists are the vast majority. That pessimism is the single greatest problem of the current social system and the deepest cause of unsustainability. A culture that cannot believe in, discuss, and develop the best human qualities is one that suffers from a tragic distortion of information. Abraham Maslow asks, how good a society does human nature permit, and how good a human nature does society permit? It is difficult to speak of or to practice love, friendship, generosity, understanding, or solidarity within a system whose rules, goals, and information streams are geared for lesser human qualities. But we try, and we urge you to try. Be patient with yourself and others as you and they confront the difficulty of a changing world. Understand and empathize with inevitable resistance. There is some resistance, some clinging to the ways of unsustainability within each of us. Include everyone in the new world. Everyone will be needed. Seek out and trust in the best human instincts in yourself and in everyone. Listen to the cynicism around you and pity those who believe it, but don't believe it yourself.
Harvey Baker speaking at the first U.S. conference on peak oil and community solutions last month. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Idaho, 91.3 Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. Harvey Baker took questions from the audience, and he began by responding to a question about his own community.
My community is not full, and we are open to the possibility of new members. We're not advertising for them. We didn't find that to be a particularly productive way to look for new members. So we are open. There are many communities that are either looking for new members or are willing to discuss that with people. Okay, here is your connection to the most amazing amount of information you can find. The other thing I recommend absolutely, even though it's not the Bible, it's the best book ever written on how to form a community. It's out on the table that Community Service is selling. And it's, I think, what is it called? Living Together?
Creating a Life
Together by Diana Christian. It if you get that book and you want to start a community, that will save you a lot of heartache. It won't necessarily avoid all the challenges, but at least it'll get you avoiding a lot of the common mistakes.
Harvey, do you have an integrated and, in brief, sustainable agriculture, permaculture, and do you have renewable energy technologies that you as a community have used so that you're self-sufficient?
No. We have, I have a car. I have no alcohol fuel for it. In fact, one of the challenges in rural community living is that people, especially if you don't have your businesses on site, people are pretty well tied to cars. Now, bicycles are an option, and I use a bicycle a fair amount, but there are times when I have to haul something big and heavy, like a mantle to Boston, and so I use a car. And there are ways that my community activism work creates a pattern of consumption that I have to be a little bit uncomfortable with.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay. My question is about the learning how to live together. Mm-hmm. There's an organization. I'm not really clear on the name of it, RECI or something of that nature. I think that Patricia would be more aware of this.
RECI.
Well, you know, it's the one that Kim. It's where you learn.
RC, Reevaluation Counseling.
Right, and
perhaps you could make a comment
because that's something that everybody could become tuned into.
There's a good tool for helping people adjust to the realities of their lives. It's not necessarily a tool for curing schizophrenia by itself, but it's called Reevaluation Counseling. It's a peer counseling system. There are people all over the country and all over the world who do this. I've been trained in it minimally and done it some. Patricia knows about it. There are people in that organization who are true believers who feel like this is the answer to all the world's problems. Well, we know there's another problem here, at least one more, called peak oil. But it is a valuable tool for understanding yourself and other people, helping yourself and other people adjust and withstand the hurts that happen to us in our lives. So I recommend it. I don't recommend thinking that it's going to be the ultimate answer for humankind.
But on the internet, how would you, Patricia, do you know what rc.org.
Okay. One more question?
Yeah. This is actually more in the sense, back here, Harvey.
Okay. Here.
Yeah. This is more a quick comment in the form of a plug, but we have found since moving to Ohio, there's a real need for communities in Ohio. Compared to the East Coast, there seemed to be a dearth of intentional communities, and I'm part of a group that's trying to form one in the Northeast, but we'd also like to network with people around the state, and I will be in your breakout group to talk to anybody mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. who's interested.
Thank you. Okay.
Okay. Homes, or are the houses scattered around? Are your homes clustered?
My community, there are a variety of ways to start a community, and my community was a little odd. We became a community of people and recognized that fact and said, what are we going to do with it? We were living in Champaign-Urbana. Around, you know, most of us had come to that town because of the University of Illinois for one reason or another. I taught there. Some people were students there. And a lot of people, this was the early 70s, people were forming worker-controlled collective businesses. We were communists, in one sense or another. And the first odd thing was that these worker-controlled businesses got together and started taxing themselves to create a fund to help other worker-controlled businesses get started. That meant they had business to do together, they got to know each other, they started. You know, it promoted people utilizing the other cooperative businesses. So you could get just about anything you needed except for maybe a living space from one of these businesses. You could get food, auto repair, clothing, records, you know, the real essentials like music. That became a community of people, and some of the folks were living in cooperative houses. I was living in a house in town. There was another place out in the country. And we realized we were a community, and it was a precious thing. And we were living in a place of high transiency. Any university town, people are coming and going. We decided, what are we going to do with this? And we looked around Illinois, central Illinois, and land was $2,000 to $3,000 an acre, and it was flat cornfield, polluted. And some friends happened to go to Tennessee to visit Stevens Farm and said, oh, this is a great area. And so we went down, and we didn't look next door. We looked a county away and found a piece of land that's 160 acres. It was $200 an acre instead of $2,000. It had no buildings on it, but it was a beautiful piece of land. It was ugly when we bought it, but it was a beautiful piece of land. And we started building our houses. There were no houses on it. We bootstrapped our way through. A lot of the people had no economic skills at all when they got there. They painted barn roofs, they built, you know, strand wire fences, anything they could do to make money.
Okay, thank you so much, Harvey.
Okay.
That was Harvey Baker in discussion last month with the attendees of the first annual conference on peak oil and community solutions in Yellow Springs, Ohio. The staff of Community Service, the organization that put on the conference, had just returned from a trip to Cuba. Back to moderator Megan Quinn as she introduces Pat Murphy, Director of Community Service.
We've got a great afternoon. As you know, we just got back from Cuba a few weeks ago, and something that I heard all over the place in Cuba was the phrase, si se puede, it can be done. So, honored to welcome back Pat Murphy.
I feel a lot better talking about Cuba and the nuclear war. First gave my first talk on peak oil in this room 2 years ago, and I learned about it, and like many people, it was pretty upsetting. And I'm saying, well, it looks serious, no one knows what to do. And Antioch students always do this. They say, well, you should go to Cuba, they've already fixed the problem. And I thought, what can he be talking about? So I did some further checking on that, and he was right, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. First, just to review, the problem is we're going to run out of oil, and we're going to have to do something about it. Secondly, the decline could be steep. This is a chart by Robert Duncan, and he really shows an industrial civilization of about, say, 1930 to 2030, and we'll be moving back into that kind of lifestyle, which I personally don't think should be a matter of concern, and I'm going to explain why. I don't think the alternatives are going to fill the gap. I learned a lot from David here, and I'm certainly have to review my own thoughts on biofuels. There's probably more there to be gained. Nonetheless, even though we have things that are rapidly growing, I don't believe, and I even think David mentioned this, don't try to duplicate the amount of energy we're using. So I'm focused on how do we reduce the amount of energy we're using. To me, the best response to peak oil is to change the American way of life. That's change our lifestyle. Now, our presidents say, well, this is not negotiable. I don't really think it's a question of negotiation. You don't exactly negotiate with a hurricane or a typhoon. If this is the way nature's going to handle it, then we should adapt to it. And for me, this is simply a new way of life is a low-energy lifestyle. We lived for, I don't know, people say we've been around for 7,000 or 15,000 years, and Charlie pointed out we didn't have any trouble with agriculture until 50 years ago. So I don't think there's any question that we're going to become sustainable. It's just how are we going to do it. In terms of where we focus is, and I want to emphasize that I think that there's going to be a lot of exciting things that can happen. There's going to be work done in cities, and there'll be some innovative things done in suburbia. My goal is just on small local energy communities, so I don't offer this as the solution. I just offer it as a solution is the one I'm focused on. I think people are happier and life is better. I have reports that I don't have here that says every time you make a survey, people say they'd prefer to live in small communities. I think they can be much more energy efficient. The fundamental aspect of small community philosophy is one of cooperation as opposed to the general world of competition. And I think social interaction is preferred to consumer goods. I only recently moved to Yellow Springs, but I've been visiting it for about 16 years. And every time I came back to Yellow Springs, I noticed people, they don't seem to have very many fancy clothes, and they don't have fancy houses, and the cars are kind of a little questionable. But they all have a good time, and they're always talking to each other, and they're always going places, and seem to be going to parties. And I think, in general, social interaction is what we do. I once had a lecture from, Huberto Maturana, who wrote a lot on languages, and he said, if you look at the design of the human hand, it's designed for stroking, not for making tools and technology. So community gives us a cultural view that's satisfied with a low-energy lifestyle and doesn't view this as some great loss. So how do we take the first step? Well, let's talk about what one looks like, some of the main categories, and list some alternatives and see if we can get there and just how hard that will be. And I'm going to talk about this and then explain what the Cubans did when they experienced peak oil with about 15 minutes warning. A low-energy lifestyle is certainly there'll be more walking and cycling and less driving, reduced size of meals, houses, and cars. If you actually look at that, it isn't too hard to translate immediately into better physical health. I think we have more home economics where people are actually working in the home. And what, like Harvey's talked about, the way he works and all these other aspects of the way you live where you don't live a completely separate life with parents going off and leaving the kids to be babysit by CNN or whoever does that. I think there'll be less mobility. People will not move as much for jobs, and that means they're not going to break the bonds of community that they've had and try to recreate it in some future place. I think we're going to have a lot of live local entertainment. There's a lot of entertainment that goes on here in Yellow Springs, and you saw example of this last night. These guys are great artists, and tomorrow I hope they'll come over and finish remodeling the porch. But they sort of incorporated in their way of being. I think there's a higher quality of life, which is the benefit from a lower standard of living. Many, many social indices show declining quality of life. The faster the GDP goes up, the more in the tank all these other indices go. If you haven't ever heard of it, there's a tremendous book called Bowling Alone, in which a guy did a study of what he calls social capital, because he was an academic, and what we really mean is community. And he just shows in a very thick, very scientific book that the more things have been growing, the more oil we've been using, now that I know about peak oil, the worse ordinary life gets. So it's really contrary to the American way of life, but you know, the American way of life has not always been a way of consuming. I was raised in the Ozarks, and we never talked about consuming and things like that. We talked about baseball, and we got older as whether we'd get a date and other aspects, but we didn't really learn about spending and getting stuff. And prudence and thriftiness were always important to us. In terms of what we are doing is we're leaving this tremendous legacy of things like nuclear waste and buried CO2 plus air CO2. Well, I had lunch today with a couple of people. We were talking about the plans for the new devil word, sequestration, in which you take all the carbon off the carbon fuels and you somehow put these together and you mix them with some god-awful chemical and you pump them into the ocean, and they're supposed to sit down there and sink and not do any harm. We have to take consideration for our children and grandchildren, and for God's sake, let's not bet the world on some exotic technology. So I'm going to just touch about these other categories. I do a lot of work in some of the other areas, but I want to hit these top four. If you look at food in the last century, we've increased the cultivated area by a third, harvest by six times, world population's increased, and fossil fuels' use has increased by 150 times. So the Green Revolution, this wonderful thing we really created, was we figured out if you kind of trick the seeds a little bit and put oil and natural gas on the ground, you can triple the yields. And that has worked for a while with great, great devastation. My sister who's visiting me said, well, you forgot to put something here on about health, and pointed out that a third of the people in this room probably will get cancer. And we talked about that, well, this cancer is a disease of modern civilization. Modern civilization is based on fossil fuels. Therefore, cancer is based on fossil fuels. That's just an equation to kick around a little bit. The industrial agriculture, we've heard this. We have horribly growing obesity rates, tremendous wasteful in terms of the fossil fuel required. It's inefficient, it injures the environment and wildlife, things that have been covered in great detail by other speakers. We look at our energy intensity versus low energy food. We will reduce all the frozen and packaged foods consumption. One of the things that we don't realize is as we sit here scattered across the country is a bunch of buildings partially buried with machines that are processing fossil fuels, and they're keeping the green beans frozen until we're ready to eat them, say, next March. The organic food movement is sort of self-explanatory, and it's really been good for me to hear how many people are aware of the knowledge that on a per-acre basis we can produce more food and better food. In terms of jobs, I think there will be tens of millions of new farmers needed, and I'm going to talk about this relative to the workforce, that labor-intensive farming is better for the soil and more productive. I always run around asking any group how many people would like to farm, and I've always discovered that somewhere around 20 to 30% of the people raise their hands. Some people love farming, some people love building web pages, and I don't think there'll be any shortage of it as long as people are paid what they're worth. There's a great writer, Fulk Gunther, in Sweden. And he has written, and his information is available on the web, that we can get a 5-to-1 energy reduction in our crops with not too much effort. Some of the other changes, the CSAs, the move to animal traction rather than tractors, and animal traction being much more healthy for the soil, use the sun and wind for drying foods, and let everyone start to take food and agriculture responsibly. We can no longer remain ignorant of energy and health issues. I think someday that people will go to get medical insurance and they'll take a physical and someone will say, well, you know, your obesity factor's here, and let me look at that. And he says, yep, that's $300 a month for you. And that point we'll say, oh, I kind of get it. This can be expensive. And finally, I think food growing and nutrition should be part of the school curriculum. So we have, you know, on the left, the fundamental choice of fields that are live and interesting to look at, and on the right we have the miles and miles of what I think they're Brussels sprouts. Now, what about car energy? That's always a big one. Oh, by the way, I wanted to say that Charlie pointed out that we've been doing agriculture and he didn't have any worry. And I said, well, that's good, because I've been figuring out how we can do all those other things real easy, and I was worried about agriculture. So my mind is now put at ease, and I'd like to put yours at ease. We can make cars smaller and lighter, and we can also drive less. I've driven a lot less now because I simply asked myself, is this trip necessary? And it turns out most of them aren't. There's a lot of times I just want to get in the car and go down and get a some ice cream. We know from the 70s that we can drive slower, and we know that we have a very, very high improvements in the area of 20-30% by reducing the speed limit. We can give up solitary driving. We have 1.3 people per trip now. We can easily move that to 3 passengers. Now, this, by the way, does affect the American way of life, which is I don't want to ride with a stranger or anybody. This is my time alone. But those are indulgences I don't think we can afford any longer. And start the development of public transportation. I think carpooling and ride sharing will predominate, and I think hitchhiking will become an acceptable norm. I wrote a paper. My background is more engineering, and so I kind of look things as design problems, and I was really gratified to know that all these permaculture people who I admire so much, they're also designers, so I, as an engineer, I feel a lot more at home with them now. So I sat down and said, well, what would you do if you had, everybody had a cell phone, there are all these cars roaming around, and we decided that we had to go somewhere. So maybe someone says, I have to leave the conference at 3:15. They pick it up and dial a number, and they get the operator or some computer system. And it turns out my mother-in-law is driving through town, and they call her and say, 3:15, drop in here at Glen Allen and pick Charlie up and take him over here. This is, in terms of a technology, just about as trivial as you can get. We put God knows how many hundreds of millions into reservation systems to do something like that, and adapting it to a personal transportation system would technically be trivial. Then I think we'll see other products coming back, and of course the reduction of the speed limit. Just some examples when we think about what is available. Here's a car that was available in 1999. It's the Honda Insight. We got a Honda Insight from Barnesville, Ohio last year, and it's 64 miles per gallon, and it's real sporty. It's a good feeling. You feel really cool when you drive this. This is the Volkswagen Lupa. It gets 78 miles per gallon. It doesn't look as cool. This is really a cute car, and I've been going to Europe lately, and these are all over Europe, and they're just wonderful. They paint them in these amazing colors, and you see them. Sometimes they'll go in backwards into a parking spot, and it's just an incredible car, and I can see that the Europeans like driving these cars, 69 miles per gallon against our, I think, 22 now. This is a Volkswagen Research model, 8 horsepower, 235 miles per gallon. It looks futuristic, but it's light and it's low powered, and we could make those available very, very quickly. I want to say just a few things about homes of the future. I used to be a builder, and in the 70s I was building houses when the crisis occurred, and boy, was that interesting. And we would talk about doing something like building a 2x6 wall instead of 2x4 wall, and people would say, 2 inches, we're not getting up 2 inches. And you say, well, it's just around the edge. He says, no. Boy, as soon as that hit, people were saying, why not a 2x8 wall? So there was an immediate shift in the approach to house design. Just changed instantly. We'll have, of course, more co-housing and things like eco-villages. When you go to places like Earth Haven and CeeLo, you see this is already being done. I think the houses will include gardens. Jan Lundberg talks about biological pavement and the lawns, which we put a lot of chemicals on and then use machines to dry them to keep them sort of flat and green. They'll disappear. My wife and I kind of gave up raking the leaves now, except for the front, because we don't want to offend the neighbors, but we let the leaves fall, and then they seem to disappear, and grass does come back next year. And these other techniques, things that were common in the past in this country and are still common around the world, all are going to be used for things like water. Now, can we, I'm looking at reducing everything by a factor of 4. Can we decrease houses by a factor of 4? Well, houses are, now the average new house is 2,400 square foot. In 1950, the average house was 1,000 square foot. The only difference between now and 1950 is the average family size is smaller. The average house around the world is about 500 square feet. So you may feel you need a McMansion, but if it comes down to it, you'll be able to do everything you're doing in your house in a lot less space. And you have to work a lot less because you don't have to make the payment. Increasing wall, roof, and floor thickness is just real basic. In the 70s, I ended up building some solar houses, and all I did was write and find out how the Swedes and the Norwegians did it. So there's no rocket science here. We can reduce the amount of windows, and we can double and triple glaze. Use flash and solar water heaters and thick refrigerators and freezers. All this is also 1970 technology. My brother-in-law, who's somewhere in the crowd, has been using SunFrost refrigerators for years, and my mother-in-law has them. So these are things with walls about this thick. We can use heat storage in various ways, like either passive solar or rock and water storage, and these techniques also have been known since the 70s. To me, being a builder and an engineer, is shelter design is really pretty straightforward. You make the shells just as thick as possible, and you don't put as many openings in them. This is some of the work done at the NHN Cold Climate Development. Also, you note one of the big differences is small capacity, single unit heating systems rather than these very, very leaky forced air systems. This is a minor inconvenience, but kind of a major savings. There's been just amazing insulation technology improvements since the 1950s, as well as new glass. Probably the most efficient thing going, if you were going to do any type of energy return on energy investment, is modern insulation. So we have these high-energy houses, 500 to 600,000 square feet. You spend a lot of money, and as I said, the average new home is 2,400 square feet. Then, all across the country, we find these really great low-energy homes, the Habitat for Humanity. They're less than 1,000 square feet, and they don't cost very much. And again, these are still much greater than the average size in the world. You know, Millard Fuller is head of Habitat for Humanity, and he's just done absolutely remarkable work. And he said, when I started building, we were building houses for something like the lower 40% of the population. Now we're building it for the lower 13% of the population because we got this fixed limit at 1,000 feet. And he was just pointing out that people were just no longer satisfied with that, except the real tragedy is it's no longer available, so we're not sure they wouldn't be satisfied with it. Habitat for Humanity is working with Oak Ridge to come up with a zero-energy house. So without much to do, Millard Fuller just continues on to come up with affordable housing that's of high quality, and now he's going to add low energy. Community structures, I think cities will become smaller. Folk Gunther, the previous reference, points out that you have to replace a building about every 60 years, and if you plan it wisely, then you just don't replace them in these various places. And he has this wonderful model of a city over a period of time in which you just make the decision to open up the green areas and do the replacement in a village on the other distance. So you take that focus city and then you shrink it down with a lot of green areas and then move things into the outlying areas. And since you have to spend the money to do this, just use a little intelligence. I believe and hope that small rural towns will grow and flourish and that lot sizes will shrink. I think we'll have a lot of energy systems, and people know all about that. That also, technology has been around now for a long time. The big issue that's brought up, it will be, again, cultural values and land use. I think people, they'll live locally, and they'll learn quickly to enjoy it. Harvey pointed out the problems of zoning is how can you mix things, and I think that's another thing that we can see these obstacles, and they're going to collapse rapidly when peak oil becomes well known. And I finally think that zoning is eventually, when we finally understand the concept of energy return on energy invested, and we actually use that in everything we do. So, you know, I glance at someone's shirt and I say, well, I think that's about a 5,000 BTU shirt. So we really learn to look at things in terms of their energy, and then our analysis would be fairly simple. So now I get to talk about what I love. When we heard about Cuba, we tried to figure out how to go there, and of course the government frowns on that. But I read about 20 books and finally got down there. And Cuba is really unique in the world today. We're talking about our oil use and reducing it, whether it be, well, 2%, 3%, my God, what if it's 5%? Cuba reduced their oil over 50% in 1 year. I would say actually in 1 month. The way I hear the story in Cuba is Castro got on television. He says, God, things are going to be a little bit tough, and we're not going to get any oil. And people went and they thought about that. And 1 week later, the tankers stopped coming in. So it was not, we should take 6 months and think this through. They got a small amount of warning. Per capita energy use in Cuba is now running between 1/15th and 1/20th of the U.S. use. Cuba is changing from an industrial to an agrarian society. Sometimes you'll hear they'll write about the modernized peasantry, because they looked at it and they said, well, we don't have any choice, and this is what we're going to do. So they're just doing it and not lamenting the fact, but they are moving more and more away from industrialism and more towards agrarian. So in doing that, they put a lot of their efforts into things like biotechnology, not genetic engineering, but rather how can you come up with a better worm for worm castings, and how can you deal with this field over here in West Cuba that has this particular infestation? What kind of biological agents can you use? Focus on Cuba, and part of the issue I see that we have is what are we going to do? Like if I'm not worried about the next car or the addition to the house and getting the latest styles, what am I going to think about? Well, Cuba's focused on building human resources. They said, well, let's invest in the people. So they have a tremendous medical care. They have far more doctors per capita than we do, and teaching is kind of the major effort. So their view is we're going to have really top medical care, we're going to have great teaching, and we're going to have wonderful sports. So there's a national strategy is let's focus on sports. Sports is very low energy. You know, you get out and run a few miles every day and get better, and then you have a contest. So we visited Cuba 3 times in the last 18 months, and this is what I'm talking about. The Soviet personnel left Cuba when the Soviet Union collapsed, ended the subsidies, which were $6 billion annually. Their GDP went down 85% in the first 2 years. The population lost weight. The average Cuban lost 20 pounds. There was a 30% per capita calorie decline, and there were several thousand cases of blindness. It was tough, very, very tough. There was an amazing decrease in the material standard of living. There's a Cuban woman in Dayton who working at a university here, and she asked me to visit her mother, and we went down, and we just had a great time talking to her mother, and I said, well, can I interview you, because we're going to make a film on Cuba. She says, absolutely. And we talked about everything, and I said, well, what was it like when it happened? And she said, can't talk about it, just too painful. So they went through this hell, but they came out of it, and I think in conditions that were far worse than anything we're facing. So the special period, it took them, actually there was an economist that talked to us the last time, and I said, what's the difference between Cuban economics and other economics? He says, well, if we screw up, somebody dies. So we can't screw up. We come up with economic systems, and we model them, and we run a test, and then we do it. There's no sitting around talking and theorizing, but everything has to have an immediate practical result. So they began worrying about food. First thing they did was introduce private farms and farmer markets. Now, Cuba was working off the communist model, and they had large collectivized, huge farms. And they took a look at that for about 2 or 3 months, and they said, well, that chapter's gone forever. We are no longer going to do that in at least this part of the economy. So the farms became much smaller. They began a major breeding program for oxen and went to animal traction. And I don't have the numbers on this. The charts are just phenomenal. And it justifies what Charlie and other people have said, is you can get more food per acre by labor-intensive animal traction than you can in any form of industrial agriculture. They used their limited oil resources to generate electricity. And the private automobile just also went away very, very quickly. Because when you see these things and look at them and you're faced with it, it's pretty clear to see what's going to go. Today, their economy is growing at a steady rate. The food production is up to 90% of the pre-crisis period. I don't have the number here, but probably the energy inputs are down 90 to 95%. They're doing very little new housing. It's a country that uses block. Most of these are remodels, and this comes back to what's going to face us because cement is high energy intensive. The transportation is basically, here's the strategy, everybody share every vehicle. That's it. Medical care and education are above the previous levels. When we were there last, they'd reached their national goal of setting a classroom size of 15 students per teacher. I don't know what ours is now, but I don't think it's 20-something. So they're just kind of getting that down. Well, actually, what I mean by that is this is their national target. So it increases. And when you have oil dropping and transportation going to hell, medical keeps increasing because the first thing people want is they want to live. You got to have medical care. And the second thing people want is they want their children to have a good life. That means education. So as long as you maintain those two priorities, then that will happen. These are not our national priorities. Our national priorities are something else. The Cuban food was interesting. They became involuntary vegetarians. And I asked our guide about that, and I says, well, what do you think about this? You know, are you a lot healthier? And he says, oh, yeah, a lot healthier. This is better. And I says, do you like it? And he says, oh, I just hate it. He says, I love pork. Cubans like pork. And I said, well, how do you deal with it? And he says, well, the way I deal with it is my daughter likes the food. So he's looked at it, and he says, well, I just like to eat pork fat. But his daughter is now moving into this healthier regime. They've increased their vegetables and their starch content. They really decreased their wheat and rice production because this is a green revolution crop and requires a lot of energy inputs. But in recent years, they've learned how to grow rice without high energy inputs. So rice is making a comeback. The urban gardens are unbelievable. When you go into this city and you expect to see things, and you know how you drive from the country to the city and there's farms, now you're in the city. Well, you go in Cuba and the farms are everywhere. Everything is under cultivation. If a person sees a plot of land in Havana and decides to farm it, they just write a business plan. They go to the government and says, there's an empty plot here, and the government looks at the business plan and says, this looks pretty reasonable. It's yours, and they start farming it. The rural areas improved the education for farmers, and one of the things that Cuba saw is they had to stop this drift from the country to the city because they had to go the other way. Well, one of the things they did is we have to make country living very, very attractive. So they did things like the University of Havana was centralized, and they decentralized it, and they put it out into the provinces. So Cuba is always focusing on how can we decentralize, moving things out of Havana and into the other areas. Farmers, by the way, are very well paid. The average successful farmer makes more than the average engineer and just about what the average doctor makes. Well, you know, I think I have that on another chart because I can't remember it. I believe it's further down. Now, this is really great is... if you think about this a little bit, and you've got this denuded field somewhere, and you've been driving and hauling tomatoes 200 miles to Havana, and you think, well, what can I do with this? And then you say, well, why don't I move the farm to Havana? Because then I don't have to drive it. You say, well, how do you move a farm? You say, why don't I just build these things, go out to the farm areas, set these on parking lots, and bring the soil in, and then start planting. So where they didn't have good soil, they would build these raised beds. And if you look at it, last time I was there, I was looking at this really great farm, and I said, why don't you have raised beds? Because we saw raised beds over here. And he says, well, raised beds, is we put it when the soil needs building up. So he says, this is really good soil, so we don't have those there. But what everything was designed is how do you keep this moving the food around the country? You just bring it in and you try to grow it locally, and they do it very successfully. This is a beautiful farm. This is what they'll call the modernized peasant. I call it the modernized agrarian because peasant to us is pejorative. He makes more than an engineer. This particular farm, when you think, well, do Cubans have some new rigid system? This is a feminist farm. And there were 13 women that formed this farm. And they said, we run this farm, and it was a sort of a collective, and we make joint decisions. It sounded really great, really, you know, far left. And so I said, well, there's a bunch of men over here. And they says, oh, yeah, we let men in here, but they can't vote. I said, oh, okay. So it's a feminist farm, but the men come in, and they I guess this, maybe it's justice. Maybe they get paid slightly less than the women farmers, but probably not. Oxen replace tractors. They started a huge breeding program and training for oxen. And if you know anything about the like tractors really compact the soil, and the oxen are much easier on the land. This is really some of the places we visited, and they have this amazing rooftop gardening. And one of the things I learned on this last trip, because I'd been to these other, and I said, well, this is nice. I said, you know, where did you get your theory? And they says, oh, it's permaculture. And I said, permaculture? You mean this thing from Australia? And they said, yeah. And I said, well, how did that happen? And they said, well, I don't remember the details, but I remember a bunch of Australians came in the lean times carrying their sleeping bags and bringing boxes of food because they didn't know what they were going to find. They thought maybe they were going to come into a famine area. So it looks to me like the permaculture people looked at this and they went in to help. And so permaculture is extremely well known in Cuba. I talked to one guy, and God, I think we intervened for 2 hours on permaculture. This is a rooftop food system, and it's a little hard to see, but it's a combination of rabbits, chickens, and hamsters. And then, and this is the covered area, and over there to the right, you have grass areas. So they're growing grass for the rabbits. The rabbits poop, that goes to the chickens, which wasn't what I wanted to hear, but that's the way it works. And the hamsters clean up everything underneath. So this is, and then where does he market this? He markets it to the neighbors. So here's a system in Havana that's providing the meat for the neighborhood.
Do they eat the hamsters too?
Yeah. You don't like chickens, I can tell. We have chickens now, and I really learned to like the chickens. You know, each one's different, and they behave, and they come out of the coop differently. So, you know, hamsters are cute, but chickens are also cute, so when you're hungry, right? This is another really great urban garden, and that big tower behind is it's the equivalent of our, the pyramid, the Washington Monument, because behind are all the government buildings. So this is like it would be having a huge farm on the edge of the Potomac River in Washington. Now this farm, We had a really charismatic guy, and I said, well, how do you run this farm? He says, well, I run the farm. I'm the president. I said, you're the CEO? He says, definitely. Okay. And how does it work? And he says, well, there's a bonus system. It was really like talking to an American corporate CEO. We've got these people. Here's the bonus systems. Here's the production that's posted. The one level of worker gets $300 a month. Managers get pesos. Managers get 400, and I get 500. And I says, so you really run? And he says, I run it. I says, well, what I don't like you? And he says, well, I don't get reelected. And I said, what? He says, yeah, I run, you know, I ran, so far I've had, this is my third term, and I'm going to run for reelection again. So I've talked to these women who run this farm, and what I see in Cuba and what I think will happen here is this tremendous innovation appears. Because the government, you know, the government probably looked and said, well, this is the cost to fix this situation, and this is the budget, and says we can't do anything. And in Cuba, there's a constant effort to push everything down to the local level, and they'll have a series of organizations, say in a city or neighbor area, and after a while that doesn't work, and they say we need another level of organization, then down into the neighborhoods. So from the top, it's push everything out as far as you can go and get it down to the neighborhood and to the village. The housing is really tough. You can't move to Havana now unless you have a guaranteed space, which is pretty hard to get. Big effort to develop the rural areas, and there's more square foot per person now available in the rural areas than there is in Havana. The house sizes are small, maybe a quarter, one-fourth the amount of square foot per person. which also factors into my view of how can we cut our energy use by four. So you have 4-to-1 ratio, except 80% of the Cubans own their own home. Now, presumably 67% of Americans own their home, but they really own it in terms of owning it with a bank. And the Cubans own their own home. They're smaller and, of course, much more affordable. This is a really great place that we saw was an eco-village. And here we are way out in the country, and you've got this very, very dense, compact sort of row house here. These also are probably 900 square foot per person, and there's a few small houses scattered around, but what they're doing is they're keeping things compact because you don't want to take up too much soil, and you don't want to have a lot of space because you have to heat it and it takes more materials, reducing their standard of living, going to a low energy way of life. Their furnishings are very simple. Whereas we might have a kitchenaire range in $10,000 worth of cabinets, they don't do that. They have a sink and a cook stove, and things are kept at a minimal level. They have fairly simple wooden furniture and some wardrobes, but very few built-ins. Transportation is fascinating. As I said before, everything works. One of my last trips, I was driving around Cuba on a Sunday, and I noticed these people in dump trucks sort of standing like this, like stacks of people. And I thought, where are they going? This is the dump trucks, and you're jammed with people. And he says, well, they're all going to the beach. So dump trucks can carry about 50 people to the beach. Hitchhiking is an accepted alternative. All the young people hitchhike. In some cases, it's illegal not to pick up hitchhikers. They have a highway patrol, people in yellow suits, and all the license plates have a designation and a color. So if there's any government vehicle, the highway patrol stops it, and you'll be driving down the highway, and there's a guy in a yellow suit and a bunch of people standing around. He's watching, he sees something stop, and he pulls over, and he loads people in, and off they go. So they're getting around. They're just not getting around with the convenience of driving a Hummer. Are the inspectors paid? Sometimes they pay and sometimes they don't. I've seen some of them in places where they're just hitchhiking, others where they're waving peso notes. This is the Cuban invention. They had a lot of these trailers that they got probably in Bulgaria. And they said, well, how can we get mass transportation? We're not going to go down and start digging tunnels under the ground to put in subways. So they got a bunch of cheap metal and they put this together and welded it. And they came up with the camel. It carries 300 passengers. It cost a peso, which is a penny or so, and they're always jammed. The last time our guide was there, she said, well, we call this a Saturday night special. And I says, what's that? And she says, it says sex, violence, and bad language. Cubans have an amazing sense of humor. They've got a joke about every one of their different conditions. If you go to the country, again, this is entrepreneurship. Some guy had a truck and a welding iron and some sheet metal. He put this together, put a tarp over it, on the back, welded stairs, and this becomes the bus. You also have in the country horse-drawn units, and if you look back, they all have a legitimate taxi license. Cuba had to innovate rapidly. There was no time or money for light rail or any other activity. You simply had to do something. They added incentives to agriculture, went to the free market where they gave people a big bucks if they could do well, and it was a major change from the socialist system. Government stopped regulating just about everything. The change was much more of a social transformation than a technical one. There was no solar panels and windmills that came in there, although there are some. It's successful to a certain extent because of the Cuban cooperation. The competition is not the principal social driver, but rather cooperation. It's sort of an example of community spirit. I'm on a web thing called Running on Empty, and I once wrote a long letter about Cuba. And I said, look, they can do this. And some person wrote back and says, yeah, but they're socialists. That's the only way they survived, and we're not going to fall for that trick. So I thought, well, there's a choice. So then I said, I think I'll send people the address of the Fellowship of Intentional Community. So I said, this is a really great place for community. It came back, several of them, is they're a bunch of socialists or they're a bunch of communists. So I have a sense in a certain way that we may want to die to protect the American way of life. The medical system did not collapse. The free medical care remained the top priority. Cuba has the same lifespan as Americans, and they have far more doctors per capita. Much more effort on prevention. The doctors must live in the neighborhoods that they serve. And if you know, people will say, well, a doctor's walking down the street, and out comes some guy carrying a chunk of pork, and he jerks, and the doctor points at him, and he runs over and gets a lecture on heart disease. So they're really involved in prevention because they cannot afford to, you know, do lots of bypasses. So I think the summary is Cuba has this tremendous health care, education, and diet. They have free education through high school. Higher education is limited, but not as many students go to that, but it also is free. Men retire at 60 and women at 55. The food supply is very healthy and adequate, but it's not plentiful and it's not rich. Sometimes it's very, very plain. There are no or very few material goods. They cannot afford consumption. But so it's an example of the genteel poverty, except I find them a very happy people. So it's definitely a low energy lifestyle. They changed from their industrial priority to agrarian. Of course, they're not out of the woods yet. Things are still tough, and United States pressure makes it even more difficult. So community solution summary, that peak oil's coming, denial's going to be short-lived. It'll change our way of life. And I'm talking a little bit here about what we do. We're educating and modeling the transition. Our focus, and I'll talk about this later, is what we want to build is a model village where we use looks something like more like Cuba than what we're currently doing, where we just take the task of let's use 1/4 the energy. And I don't think that's difficult once we go through the psychological problems. I want to give you a personal example. Since I came here, we moved here a couple of years ago from California, and we're looking at all this and said, well, how can we, how will we deal with this? Can we live in 800 square foot? And we thought, oh, that looks tough. And then we moved in, and about 2 weeks later, I'd forgotten that I'd lived in more space. We have our furniture store, and every once in a while we go shopping. We go out there and open this up and see these possessions that we've forgotten about and pick the ones we need. We now have chickens. We're raising eggs for the neighborhood. If the neighbors complain, we give them some eggs and they back off. We're gardening, and the next door neighbors ask us, would you take our land now? So next year we'll take the rest of it. We've replaced a furnace in the house with efficient units, and we're going to do more. We're going to be building some 6-inch walls on the inside and figuring out how to design and build window covers, because we're going to get down to that 4-to-1 level. I think it's important to remember what Albert Einstein said, is we can't solve problems by using the same kind of thinking. And he further said that this mess that we're living in is really a disastrous byproduct of the scientific and technical mentality. That's the mentality that says we really need machines. This is a way to live. Machines run on fossil fuels. They'll last forever and they won't pollute. So I think that's the direction we're living. And what we're called for in here is to make these major changes and to start working in the way of life. I'm real happy with windmills and solar panels and all the rest of that, but I'm not going to wait till we figure out if they work. Thank you.
Pat Murphy, Director of Community Service, Inc. of Yellow Springs, Ohio, speaking last month at the first annual conference on peak oil and community solutions. Thanks to Megan Quinn, Pat Murphy, Faith Morgan, and Peter Arena for their contributions to this program. Unwelcome Guests is archived online in MP3 at radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4all.net. And we encourage you to download, copy, and distribute this material to people who can't hear this on their radio. For listeners in the Finger Lakes, the next meeting of Back to Democracy will be tomorrow, Monday, December 20th at 7 p.m. at the Perry City Friends Meeting House on Route 227 in Perry City. The Ground Truth, a film of interviews with soldiers wounded in the current war in Iraq, will be screened and a discussion will follow. It's, of course, free and everyone is welcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Welcome.